Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with James Swagger about the fascinating story of Ireland and some of the megalithic sites, a lot of the different tribes, the different invasions, the sources, and everything else that has to do with the magic of this incredible, you know, Northern European heritage that we all share and that is so similar, you know, between Scandinavia and the Irish or the British Isles and everything else. It's just fascinating listening to this and you know, talking about how similar the stories are in some cases, how similar the sites are, the stones and whatnot. There is an age difference, it seems, in some cases. I think a little bit older, some places in Ireland for sure, but absolutely fascinating. Now, I want to just basically carry on where we left off and see what more you want to, you know, get into and talk about. But we definitely can return a little bit later to the whole Halloween story and Samhain and see also how that kind of ties into some of the locales and whatnot here, James. But do please let us know if there's anything else we should kind of squeeze in before we move forward here.
Well, now that I see, the problem is you have to give so much background to the Irish origins of Halloween, and then you get into the megalithic calendar, and then you get into some of the historical accounts of the Gaelic accounts, the historical accounts from the Book of Invasions and the Book of Leinster and the Annals of the Four Masters. And then when you understand who all the players are, the Tuatha De Danann, the Milesians, the Numidians, the Fomorians, and who was warring with who, and then you get to know the names and get some of the background, then you can talk about who these people were. What it seems to be that the folklore surrounding, and I say folklore, I believe it to be historical accounts personally. I think some of it's wild, definitely to accept. I do agree, it's definitely wild to accept. However, there may be easily explainable definitions of why we can accept this stuff. Like I say, there may have been a shamanic practice, and the otherworldly part may be accounts of hallucinogenic brews. But what seems to be this group of people that I mentioned, the Tuatha De Danann, the tribe of the goddess Danu, as some people call them, sometimes even referred to as Anu, that these people later became the Ishi, the Dinishi or the Ishi. So it seems to be that they morphed into the Ishi, if you will. So when you hear the Gaelic people talking about the Ishi, they refer to these in a mythological sense, that they're otherworldly, that they're almost like elves, or they're called actually the fair folk or the folks sometimes, people of the mounds, the fairy mounds, that it's almost, the mythology is almost happening in a Gaelic Irish sense. However, the tie is very, very strong between these people and the Tuatha De Danann, that they were an actual presence, that they were historical accounts. So it's like the mythology is happening in Gaelic Ireland, 7th century, but it's also some sort of a reality too. It's very, very hard to draw the line what is historical myth and a historical account. However, most people have just washed all this away, where I believe there's a lot of historical account. So coming back to the Ishi, you know, there is a lot of mythology about that, yes. However, it's closely tied with the Samhain Halloween celebration. Most people tried to, they were referred to as a supernatural race, and that they would appease the people of the mounds, these Ishi. They were guardians of the mounds, and that perhaps because of the ritual burial rites and the lighting of fires, maybe people were scared and they didn't understand who the Ishi were. Because the Ishi, at one point during all these battles, were driven into the mounds to live out their days there, and caves of the underworld. Now, like I mentioned, the Oí na gCat cave in Roscommon, linked with the other mounds that are just outside the cave and the henges that are outside, it's like a megalithic complex. Incredibly interesting, but we have Tuatha De Danann, Ogham script links with the cave, that the people were either in the mounds or the caves. There's caves in up near Carrowkeel, megalithic cairns in Sligo as well. So these people were driven backwards into the mounds or into the caves, basically, you know, isolated. So if people were writing about these Ishi, well, they've just distanced themselves, and maybe they just didn't understand who these people were. Maybe they didn't understand their burial practices. Maybe they thought they were going to be put on the funeral pyre and it was real people that were being burnt alive. Who knows? I mean, at what point does the customs come into play? But basically, to appease the Ishi, people used to dress up so that the Ishi wouldn't recognize them. They were afraid of being taken into the other world. They were afraid of the powers or the supernatural powers that these people had. You know, maybe these people were just intellectual. Maybe they had knowledge of solar cycles and whatever and other astronomical events. And maybe these guys were very, very intellectual and not appreciated for it. That's a modern way of looking at it. But I have looked at a lot of the evidence. And like I say to you, what we've talked about in the last hour, Henrik, it's kind of sad. It's like these Ishi, the Tuatha Dé Nann were revered in their day, and then they became the Ishi. And then when we heard Ishi, it descended into a custom, and the custom seemed to be originally, treating them as supernatural and giving them offerings, and everything was great for a while. And then we have, you know, historical accounts that the Shi, the simple name for them, the people of the mountains, the Shi, sometimes people shortly abbreviate them as, they were basically being appeased with offerings of fruits and foods in the event that they wouldn't be taken by the Ishi. And this is where we get this horror aspect to Halloween. So all the ritual customs of our modern Halloween today, this Christianized date of 31st of October, if you want to call it that, is all present in Gaelic accounts of Samhain Festival. It's all there in various scattered texts and various scattered ways. And again, this is where this spirit world or other world comes into play with Halloween. Samhain, like I say, may have actually been an Ishi. He might have been one of these Tuatha Dé Nann. He may have actually been one of the people, may have been a leader. Like I said to you as well, Baal, the fire god Baal, May Day, our celebration, the Beltane festival, was pretty much its equal to Samhain. And some people prefer to celebrate the Beltane festival in Scotland and in the Scottish Islands and in the Orkneys as well. I think they still prefer to do that one more so than the Samhain one.
Huh. Now, do we know anything about the type of rituals that was going on? I mean, a little bit later, we can certainly get into how, you know, this has been skewed in a way into believing that it was all, you know, sacrificial and, you know, tying up the body on the slab of stone and, you know, whatever else, cutting out the heart or whatnot. There are certainly rituals of sacrifice, of giving back to nature, of a basic recognition of the circle of life, that death is life, perhaps, you know, contradictory, but obviously those who understand nature realize that that's just kind of part of it, and that there's a recognition of that understanding of how nature works that was part of the rituals. I think we can see this in a lot of different cultures around the world. But the fact is, do we have anything in terms of what actually was going on? And maybe later we can get into how you believe that this was transversed into what we have today, where it's very spooky and everything else, and we are associated with, sacrifice and murder and blood and everything else, right?
Well, yeah, and the thing is, this Samhain celebration may have had some sort of a sacrificing of animals, or it was a time of year you would slaughter animals for the winter. It may have been a cultural aspect that the Celts inherited in a pagan way, which maybe got somehow corrupted later on, because the Celts spread their knowledge to Scotland, and then from Scotland it spread down to England. It came back the other way then, where the English became a might or a power and pushed Scots back. However, at that point, what we have is paganism in England. Now, not to put down England in any way, I really don't want to speak derogatory of England in a way, but some of the horror accounts or the jack-o'-lanterns, the carving of pumpkins with otherworldly, and basically if you were marked by the Ishi or the spirits of Halloween, some people, they even lost the name the Ishi eventually, that there was just, they were just referred to as dark spirits floating around on Halloween. They actually referred to this time of year is when the veil between this world and the other world is at its thinnest. And that gets thrown around a lot. However, that comes from the description of the Gaelic accounts. Like I say, it reads like science fiction. However, there may have been some sort of a magnetic effect of, I mean, when you think about solstices and equinoxes, spring and autumn were actually the furthest away from the sun. And winter and summer, the earth is exactly the same distance from the sun. It's only the tilt of the earth that actually makes our summers and winters. And the halfway points in between may be unusual points in terms of being magnetically affected. Maybe our magnetic shield is less or something. Or in the same way, the magnetic field of the Earth comes online from sunrise. It's at its most, it's at its biggest change when that revolving off the Earth changes the magnetic field. It's the biggest change at the time of it's 3:37 a.m. It's where most people actually wake up in their sleep. With an epiphany, or you know, that eureka moment that you just wake up like a light is on their head. Same way, that magnetic field affects us humans. So maybe it affected us at that time of the year, the 4th of November. Again, it would have a mirror effect on the belt in it as well. It would have a mirror effect exactly that same time. So maybe there's some sort of a slightly magnetic reason, electromagnetic reason for this. Maybe it's too sensitive for us to feel today in this day and age.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
I'm going out on a limb here, but yeah. There is it is a curious astronomical point of the journey of the Earth around the Sun. Maybe, you know, ancient peoples were, you know, marking this in a sensitive way. Maybe they're sensitive to these energies and they just marked this day. And maybe they were sensitive because they were inside mounds and they were doing some shamanic practice. And maybe they met certain spirits and they named the spirits that they were on shamanic visions with. Who knows? But I think this has spilled out. And as it migrated around the British Isles, it just got further corrupted and further corrupted. And then I think we have the church coming into play, really trying to, you know, stamp it out. Because what happened was they tried their best for over 3 centuries. Now, 3 centuries is a long time to convert somebody. And if you haven't done it inside 3 centuries, you're really struggling, if you ask.
Yeah.
The Christian aspect of trying to Christianize the pagans. And like I say, nearly every megalithic place in Ireland has either a church or a cross on it. If they couldn't put a church there, it was too high up, they put a cross there. In Cairn Coran Mountain, there's caves there associated with folklore as well. And above it, they have a big giant cross, Henrik. And to get the cross up there, they must have helicoptered it in. They must have brought it in on a helicopter. The amount of concrete they put it into the ground to make that thing stand up. Because you can see the cross from anywhere in the valley.
Mm-hmm.
It's because there's megalithic cairns up there. Nobody even goes up there.
Right.
Nobody goes up there. It's so hard to get up there. I mean, I went up there, I was exploring the caves, and then I went around to the cairns, and I'm looking at this cross up there, and it's like everywhere you go in Ireland, you see this ancient megalithic place. The ones that were revered in folklore are the ones that were revered in popularity, statistically visited, if you want to call it that. You see these crosses and this Christian aspect. So I think the push from the Christianization of the paganism was really to, you know, demean what was going on. I think they spread stories and they really ramped up the campaign to get rid of paganism. I mean, if you want to look at it in terms of the Wiccan pagans don't even believe in Satan. They don't believe Satan exists, the witches. And by the way, the witch idea of a witch comes from the Tuatha Danann as well. These Ishi, one of the Ishi is called the Banshee. Ban means woman in Irish. So the woman of the mound or the women of the mounds were supposed to be special powers. So these supernatural women were known as Banshees. So we have the Ishi, just the general people of the mounds, and then we have these special women we call Banshees. Still today, Loch Crew is known as the Mountains of the Hag, or the Mountains of the Witch, basically, in Irish. That's what Loch Crew means, actually. So we have, again, witches associated with a lot of these megalithic monuments as well, especially around Loch Crew, which I said was a Samhain celebration. Nobody seems to remark on that at all. It seems to be like two obvious pieces of information that nobody seems to put together on. However, again, like I say, the Wiccan pagans, they don't actually believe in Satan. They do believe that in spirit world, and they do believe that the veil is thin at Halloween and so on, and that is the time to talk to the others. Perhaps that is true, and perhaps that, you know, the custom of trying to talk to the other world. There is an old custom as well that if somebody died, you would light a fire to guide them home to their home, and people would do that at their homes, like in Gaelic Ireland as well. So lighting of fires may have been to guide spirits or to talk to spirits. Some people then say it was to scare the spirits away, and it seems to get confused when this Christian aspect comes in. And after the three centuries, after the 9th century AD, it seems to be really this demonic aspect to it, and horror stories, really, just whether they're even true or not, it really remains to be seen, Henrik. It's just wild after that point. It actually descends into chaos of what the actual Halloween is.
Well, I mean, it's fascinating to realize that Halloween as we know it today is something that has, of course, it's transformed over the years. It's you know, more of its, I guess, stereotypical association is something that has been added on for effect over the years. But nonetheless, as you're talking about this, you realize that it's largely a Christian invention, and it's been a perversion of what really was. This has to do, of course, with not only the changing of the date there, but perhaps of associating something which could be very, I mean, just what you said about the sites of how important it is for them to place their own stuff on these, you know, what I believe are, in, maybe not in all cases, but they're energy points. They're you know, strong areas of for whatever reason, the more ancient people, they went to these sites, they saw it as sacred for whatever reason. But today they need to place something there as a marker, even how absurd it is. Just as you said, they, you know, travel for miles and no one is around, but yet they have to have their cross there. It's almost like they need to impose their own thing on these spot for whatever reason. But maybe there is something to that. Maybe there is something to the fact that they can, if they place their own stuff there, maybe something like Christianity, something that is going to be reinforced even further. We might not know how that goes today or why that even works, but it's mm-hmm. largely a Christian invention, isn't it? This is what they've done. They've pulled it out in this way, and maybe they tried to associate something that had to do with, you know, communication with, you know, the other side or what have you, with something which is really negative and scary, and stay away from this. And at best, what they've been able to do is to basically have focus people on something completely different than what you should do at that particular time of the year. What do you think, James?
Sure. To be fair, I actually think there, I don't think totally. I think at some point there was a misunderstanding. Because when you look at I look at the evidence as a systems analyst. I'm always the engineer. I'm an engineer first and a scientist second. I'm always looking at it as a problem-solving systems analyst. I take in all the data and I look at it all. I mean, yes, they made a lot of stuff up, but I mean in terms of there was some sort of core body of truth there. I think there was a lot of misunderstanding of what that core body of truth was, and eventually it just got lost. And when I say core body of truth, yes, there's nodal points of the year, like you pointed out. These key nodal points, winter, summer, spring and autumn, and then the halfway points in between. And one of the famous halfway points, this Samhain Halloween nodal point, was the one with the most ritual. So I think there was more of a campaign to shake this one off from the pagans. In other words, they were up against it. These pagans weren't budging on this stuff. Like, they were like, no, we're pagan. We like these rituals. We're not budging for anybody.
Yeah.
The thing is, I mean, yes, the megalithic mounds were inherited by the Celts. So it's like Chinese whispers. Every time you do Chinese whispers and you tell a story to somebody, somebody puts their own spin on it, and you tell it again to somebody else, and then they put their own spin on it. By the time it comes out the other end, Henrik, it you might not even recognize the story.
Yeah.
But usually, if the story is rigid, you'll usually get the core body of truth of the story and then slight variations. But the core body of truth that we know is the 4th of September. The megalithic builders were celebrating. We have the Ishi being associated with the other world, spirituality, if you will. And then we have bonfires being celebrated outside megalithic monuments. Yes, they were cremating the remains of the dead. So we have the dead, we have bonfires, we have the exact date, the 4th of November, and we have the Ishi, the other world and spirit. So we have all the key elements still there from basic megalithic knowledge at the very, very start of the story. And then it comes out the other end like some strange spin of Halloween. And now in a modern sense, it's kind of like a comedy, laughable humor to it, this Halloween spin, with the scary aspect too. There's a fine line between scary Halloween and humorous Halloween, if you will. But,
well, you know, let me just mention something real quick here. I'll be sinister here, but if what you're talking about here is a time for, you know, maybe what we would call scientific reasons, it's an excellent time to communicate with the other side or visit that side or see something else coming in from that side. Maybe it's just a, as you said, astronomically, it's a doorway. We know magnetically that we can interfere quite a bit with, you know, brain activity and all that. I mean, there's, I don't want to get lost on that, but the God helmet and all that. We know that slight variations in the magnetic field do affect us. And the only question there is, okay, does it just, you know, screw with our brain so we make these things up, or does it actually unlock something which makes us see or connect with these things? But nonetheless, with the amount of, you know, poisonous chemical candy that all these poor kids are eating around this time of year, maybe it's that it's still their way of trying to get people to the other side, isn't it? You know?
Oh yeah, not to take away from the tradition, I do think it is a time to communicate with the other side. Ironically, most people either take astrology or don't take it, but from what I look at astropsychology. I look at it, psychology, and I look at astrology in both the same two sides of the same coin. I think it's a planetary effect. Again, it's linked with solstices. You can see why I probably researched that. However, when you look at the Scorpio sign, which lands in around the Samhain, a mid-Scorpio person would be the 4th of November, the time of Samhain. They say the Scorpios are incredibly psychic, and they also understand death very well. It's two of the major aspects of a Scorpio. Very, very analytical as well. There's many, many traits of a Scorpio, but there's two of them that they understand death very well. Some people say they're morbid. But they do understand death very well. And there's a lot of psychics. Most psychics in the world are either Pisces or Scorpios. Two water signs. But Pisces because of the, for a different reason, but the Scorpio psychics are because they're in contact with that other world. And I do happen to know three psychics and they're both, and they're three of them are Scorpios. Like, so it's unusual that that time of the year that is Samhain, Halloween, you know, that is an astrological sense. And, you know, I think there's an astronomical reason for that. I do think that either, you know, I look at it in terms of electromagnetics or, you know, this key nodal point of the year as we traverse around the solar year. You know, I'm totally open to that. Not to take away from that tradition in any way. I do think that is a time to talk to the other side. I do believe that there is another side personally. However, you know, where does it go after that? I think largely after the Christianization of three centuries that, you know, it descended into chaos. I don't even know if half the stories that you read is true, but when you, a lot of the accounts that you read are from Wiccan paganism and black paganism and from around the English, which then paganism really branched off into Celtic paganism, Irish paganism, Scottish paganism, and their variant branches of it. You know, and paganism, even the words for these solar days of the year changed as well. So, you know, and we do have slightly different customs as well. You know, these offerings that you make for the Ishi around this time of year, it does change around the different Celtic languages, different Celtic, in the Brythonic branch, the Celtic languages of Brittany, Welsh and Cornish, they have slightly different names for the same festival. In Wales, it's Calan Gaeth, Cornwall's Calan Gwaeaf, Brittany's Calan Gonav, I think it is. Mm-hmm. Something like that. You know, so there's slightly variations in the names and there's slightly variations in the practices. And Manx Gaelic, they call their festival the Hoptuna. And that's it's basically their New Year's Eve. They consider that their New Year, that the darkness of winter is starting to come, and they celebrate their New Year's Eve on basically Halloween. That's their New Year's Eve to them. And the Manx Gaelic, their original name means basically this is the night, the Seacht Tan Nui. Basically, this is the night, their night, implying this is the one night of the year to be concentrating on. This is their night, basically. And again, that's the etymology for the Irish Gaelic means Ihish Samhain, basically the night in November. This is the main night in November, in other words. They're putting such emphasis on this special night as if something's going to happen or it's a time of reverence. But basically, the children in Manx Gaelic in the Isle of Man, basically, they would use turnips instead of pumpkins to carve, and they would sing some anglicised version of a witch song, and you know, they would go around trick or treating as well. And the customs seem to be slightly variant in each part of the British Isles, if you want to call it that. But the core components of the custom really kind of still pervade, and they still kind of, you go through this scary aspect in the medieval times, and then all of a sudden it's become this kind of commercialized custom today, which they kind of refer to as, you know, a medieval period. So Halloween kind of when people think Halloween, they think of this medieval period of Halloween, where really it's just like the worst representation of the facts. Really,
yeah, yeah. And they're not even scraping the surface, really, of what this thing is supposed to be about, you know? Mm-hmm. It's very bizarre there, you know, in terms of the incursion of Christianity and, of course, the destruction of you know, paganism and everything. But in later years, I feel that they're very complementary to each other. I feel that there's a large, you know, beneficial, again, this kind of stereotypical, you know, view that people have of a pagan or whatever, that that's actually served Christianity quite well in terms of, you know, how it tried to say that, oh, look, you know, these satanic practices are still in the world, you know, all these things still exist. And to a certain degree, maybe that, you know, due to that, actually helped to bring and keep more people, you know, focused on the church and going to the church for being, you know, saved from these horrible practices. But that having been said, though, is there anything that suggests in your view that there are, and it doesn't mean, you know, how well intended they are or whatever, but are there any kind of dark, you know, practices associated with this time of year? I mean, it, as we always know, it's co-opted, people take over and they run the show. They misrepresent the knowledge, what it really means and whatnot. But is there layers to that? Do you think that there are some that are just kind of more, they think they know what they're doing, but it's kind of stupid. But then you have a kind of an elite brand. So many people have talked about that you have this, you know, upper force echelon that really are getting into these kinds of dates for their own purposes and reasons.
Yeah, I think you've hit on a few points there. This is the way I see it, Henrik. I don't believe in Satan. I don't believe that there is a person called Satan, personally. I think that there are dark forces in the world, and I think there are good forces in the world. However, I make from that what you want. I think there's dark entities, and that goes for people that are into shamanism as well. I mean, I think there's a dark side to shamanism, and there's a good side to shamanism. However, I think if you want to be a Satanist and you go to a Satan group and they're telling you Satan's real and they put so much emphasis into the word Satan and they put so much emphasis into practice, it really doesn't matter if it's true or not, because people can do bad things under the banner of something else. So I could give you a rod, Henrik, and say, this is the rod of Satan and you can commit whatever you want. And you could put emphasis into this rod and you could make this whatever you want.
Yeah.
You know, people will follow blindly. And people can do bad things under a banner. I think there is satanic groups out there who do things as misguided souls, as cruel people, as evil people. But I don't think that Satanism or the Church of Satanism is a real eligible entity that's believable, if you know what I mean by that.
Yeah, sure.
So I think that there are groups out there that can organize themselves, that can self-organize themselves into cruel, evil, malicious people or groups and breed that philosophy to others. It doesn't make it any more real. It doesn't make it right viable in terms of a historical. And you could say that this is a practice going back to four centuries. It doesn't mean that the original fourth century practice is true or real. It's just something that somebody made up and people continue to do. And I think a lot of Satanism attaches itself to a lot of this pagan stuff. When I say pagan stuff, I mean the cross quarter days. And I met Thomas Sheridan last weekend and I interviewed him for his book, Wild Purges Night, and a great book, by the way. And Wild Purges Night actually means Belton and May Day. And it was to talk about Hitler, psychopathology, stuff like that. And basically, I think there are groups of people that use key dates and they embody these dates of May Day, Lunacy. World War One started on the date of Lunacy, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
The 3rd of August. And I think that people will put the focus and the energy into these special dates in a numerological sense. And they use all these tricks and they use all these pagan notions or ideology, symbology in the groups. Any group does this. An advertising group would do this. A church group would do this. You know, they put ideology and emphasis and embodiment into all these ideologies. Secret societies do this as well. So, you know, does it make that true? Does it make that, you know, you know, does that make that right or wrong? It's really just the internal dynamics, if you will. Now, I will say this, the church, we're talking Roman Catholic Christianity here, who tried to paganize and successfully paganized, took the paganism out of Ireland somewhat, although they didn't kill it totally. They damaged it, and they did a good job to decimate it, but they didn't stamp it out fully, and it still goes today. I think it was a tall task for them to take on. However, what we do see is that they incorporated a lot of the pagan traditions into their doctrine, into their church, in the attempt to shift the days, in an attempt to move this stuff in date and ideology and symbology. However, I think they have fallen prey to the very thing that they were trying to convert. And I think that in the church itself, that they, I mean, you look at the Easter celebrations, it's all done around solstices and equinoxes. St. Bridget's Festival, like I said to you, and that's the Imbolc Festival. So on, the All Souls Day. And if you look at the hierarchy of the church today, I think it's fallen victim to itself. Whether that's down to paganism, I don't think so. I think there are dark forces within the church. However, yeah. I do think, and not to go too conspiratorial, I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that. I do think there are dark forces within the church. I'm not blaming them trying to adopt paganism as it. Quite the opposite. I think they have used paganism in the same way as other groups to their own devices, basically to do and sell a philosophy. I think they're no different to a secret society. They're no different to a faction, a political faction. They're no different to governments. All these are organized groups. The same as Satanists as well. They're all organized groups, and organized groups will do anything to sell their philosophy.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I agree with you. I mean, it's just look at what was done in their name to the reality of the horror and the plague they put upon so many different people around the world, in, you know, as a measure of trying to do, you know, again, either what they believed was the right thing or what have you, or if they were, you know, misguided or whatever. But I can't help to see it as it's just one big hijacking attempt to steer away from, you know, the real deal. A lot of people in the conspiracy circles, they pin, you know, Satanism, occultism, and paganism together as one, as the kind of, oh, that's the root of all evil. But, you know, that's missing the most obvious thing in the room here, which is, of course, that when Christianity came into a lot of these places, these were, I believe, very well-meaning people that were living, you know, way back when, and they were minding their own business. They're not trying to create empires or whatnot. They were doing their own thing, what they were doing. Christianity is something that arrived at their door, and a lot of violence and bloodshed came with that as well. I mean, we hear stories in the Norse, from Norse mythology, or, you know, the stories there when Christianity came in, that they were forced to convert, or they were murdered in front of their own families. People were hung up in the most horrible ways. They were tortured. They were left alive, being, you know, tortured for days on end and things like that. That's not a nice legacy to carry on itself. And if people want to look at what they today deem as Satanism, well, you know, then you really need to re-examine the occurrences in history. And I'm not saying that the church today represents these things and can carry all the blame for this, just as you blame, you know, other people for things, what happened in history or whatever. But just for the sake of fairness and accuracy and looking at history, I think it's a very different picture that begins to emerge once you're being honest and realize what actually happened, you know?
I don't know how much time we've got left, but it's probably a good time to mention the Kazakhstan pentagram. And the pentagram is a symbol associated with Satanism. However, the pentacle is a Celtic pagan symbol. In other words, a five-pointed star upwards. And just as we're talking about ideology and symbology, in the same way the Celtic pagans had this five-pointed star, it was a good symbol. It didn't mean anything other than an expression of ideas and notions. Each point of the star would represent earth, fire, wind, and water, and the top one would be spirit, facing upwards. And that was sort of five key elements. This five-pointed star would be in a circle. That is neither good nor bad, really. That's just an expression of ideas. However, what we see is the pentagram, the five-pointed star facing downwards, representing the sigil of Baphomet, or a satanic symbol. That's a corruption of ideas, and like we just expressed, this pops up in the Kazakhstan pentagram, and I made a discovery with my co-host, and it was live on air when we did this, and I know you've seen the video, to make a reference to that. If everybody wants to look that up, you can go to YouTube and Kazakhstan pentagram 666 and you'll find it. However, what we have is everybody seems to have ignored this. I personally think there was a group of people there using this ideology and symbology for something. I'll leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I do see is a covering up of the evidence. What I do see is the evidence saying that they put that pentagram in the tight corner of Kazakhstan in the middle of nowhere at the edge of a lake. It was so inaccessible. The only way to get that is by an aerodrome and by boat, of which is there across the water, seen on Google Earth. I put an 18-minute condensed version together. I've been censored over it. I think the key elements to mention is that it's at an elevation. The center of the star is at an elevation of 666 feet above sea level. The key thing about that is there is very few places in Kazakhstan at that altitude above sea level. It's so mountainous there. Most of it's really, really high. There's very few low-level places. At that, I would say there was only a handful of places that would be in or around 1,000 feet above sea level. So that in itself is a rare, rare commodity of that, looking at the data of the Kazakhstan pentagram. Second of all, it's got a radius of 666 feet. And the five points of the star don't touch the circle. The five points of the star are at a radius of 444 feet, which is another way of writing 666 multiplied by 0.66. It's a harmonic, and this is what we see secret societies or other ideologies or symbologies expressing ideas with harmonics. They play around with numbers. Personally, I think, I've looked at this. I mentioned to you earlier that we have megalithic henges with 666 feet in diameter, and we have 555 feet in diameter. Again, another harmonic of the 666. And is the 666 a satanic number? It's just a number. A number is a number. It's in a pure numerology sense, you can express the numerology of something with a number and it not mean anything. If a group then takes that number, well, then there may still be a geometric reason why you have 666. It doesn't mean that the original ideas are now all Satanists. But what we do have is megalithic henges at two known diameters. The two biggest henges in Ireland, Belfast Henge is at a diameter of 666 feet, and we have Doth Henge right beside Newgrange at 555 feet in diameter. Now, 555 feet is also wrote in inches as 6,660 inches for those that want to check that out. We have this crazy numerology going on at these megalithic chambers too, or megalithic sites as well. And it's not just stopping in Ireland, that we have Thornborough Henges in Northern England, the three henges representing Orion's Belt. Two of the henges, I believe, are 555 feet in diameter, and the other one is 666 feet in diameter. We have other henges in Germany, again, 666 feet in diameter. There's an outer ring around Stonehenge, 666 feet as well. As well as this 666, we also have other henges at 216 feet. 216 might not seem as a surprising number, but when you multiply 6 by itself 3 times, in other words, 6 by 6 by 6, you get 216 feet. I personally believe, and I have looked into the evidence of other authors, and Fritz Zimmermann being one, that when you look at his work on the Ohio Valley and henges over there, this is where I got this idea. I said, well, if it's the same as the henges in the Ohio Valley, the same must apply to the European henges. And when I looked, I found the evidence, Henrik, and I was gobsmacked. I couldn't believe it. What you see is another number coming up, 1080. 666 was seen as the sun father and 1080 was seen as the lunar mother in an old historical and an old pagan sense. Has this idea been corrupted by groups somewhere down the line? Yes, no doubt. That's probably why the Kazakhstan pentagram is encoded with this information. Do we think they're up to any good there? I don't think so. I don't think these guys are up to any good at all. I think it's sinister at the very, very least. And I think it's a corruption of ideas. Again, the Washington Monument, 555 feet in height. Are they using an old numerology system? I have no doubt. Does that make them evil? I don't know. I just think that this numerology is encoded in a sacred geometry of henges, in monuments, modern and ancient. And I think that this ancient system is of knowledge and numerology is dating back to the Amorites. Basically, the people who invented the unit of foot, the unit of feet and inches, were the Amorites. They invented sacred geometry. They gave us this science of gematria, as it's called. And gematria is basically these numerologies and how they all play and interline with each other. There is a little formula, by the way. If you multiply 555 by pi, you will get 1080 plus 666. And we have 555, 1080, and 666 in all the hinges of the world. These three numbers come up time and time again. Again, you know, 1080 is an incredibly sophisticated number. You can break it down to 3 times 360. 360 is the number of degrees in a circle. Again, the Amorites invented this. Spherical geometry is based on the Amorites' base 60 system as well. And the base 60 system keeps on going. It's encoded into everything. It's in their time system. And all roads head back to the Amorites. Ironic that the Amorites are dated to 2750 BC, Henrik. It's a lot to cram in the last few minutes. I've just fried people's heads with this numerology stuff. But it's there. If you want to watch the video, I just urge you to have a look at it. Tell me what you think. I would love to get some more information on the Kazakhstan pentagram. There was one person that looked into this who was 1,000 miles away, never visited the site, and looked at the same thing and was told what to say. Basically, nothing to see here, go home. They never mentioned Satanism. They never mentioned the sigil of Baphomet from what it is. They never even mentioned anything to do with 666. They actually gave out the wrong measurements. You can actually take a ruler on Google Earth and measure this yourself. You know, it's uncanny that it's at a diameter. You could overlook that, but the fact that it's at 666 feet above sea level, I have no doubt that that place was chosen for its numerology. Take from that what you will. I will say that the person that looked into that was looking at burial sites nearby. There was burial sites at that remote corner of Kazakhstan. And then they throw out some really ludicrous ideas of what this thing actually was. They said it was a Russian star. You know, Russian stars aren't the wrong way up. I think the Russians have managed to get their Russian star the right way up all the times that they used it. There is the Russian city of Astana in Kazakhstan. It's got so much ideology and symbology there. There's not even a Russian star there. You know, if you're going to put a Russian star, that's where you would have seen it.
Yeah.
And not only that, you know, this apparently it was a park. First, one idea said that people said it was a park, although you can't get to it. You can't even get to it by a Land Rover. You would have to drive for miles by a Land Rover to get to this thing by rough terrain. This thing is so inaccessible. People said it was a Russian missile silo. Same reason. You wouldn't put a Russian missile silo where you can't get to it. You know, so the fact that this thing is inaccessible speaks volumes. And that's what made me look into the remoteness of this thing. And when I looked across the water at the lake, I could see what looked like an aerodrome strip. You can visit this on Google Earth. And the aerodrome strip I measured to be the exact length of a runway that would land a Cessna. So it's accessible by plane by a very remote group of people. Like, and whoever owns the aerodrome across the water from the Kazakhstan pentagram knows what it's used for, I have no doubt. Why they don't ask these people, you know, in the nearby vicinity what this thing is, as opposed to an archaeologist 1,000 miles away who's never seen the site and has been told what to say, basically. But
well, it's a very interesting story, James. And we do have to wrap up here just very, very shortly. But I wanted to give you, of course, few seconds, give out your website again, give us the book title and everything else. But just before we end here, I'd love to have you back again. There's so much more to this story and other things connected with this that we could, you know, continue to talk about. So before we wrap things up here, give us your details, but please consider to come back again here soon with us, James.
Sure. Well, like I say, megalithic henges, I have stumbled upon some of this numerology. It's my current area of research, and I'm working hard at that at the moment. I'm still doing tours. I'm going to publish a little article on the numerology of henges very soon. And you'll get that on jamesswagger.com. All my stuff is there. And I have a new publication now, so we should maybe do a show on that in the not-too-distant future. That's the Megalith Acoustic Mystery. I've held off 6 months publishing that. I just can't wait to get it out there. And I'm really keen for that because, like I say, the acoustics is one fascinating, definite area of research into these monuments as well. And like I say, I've took this... my aim was to systematically look at this evidence. You know, I looked at first the astronomy, then I looked at the acoustics, and then I'm systematically taking each area of research bit by bit, And then the henges is the last thing I've had to look at. There are other types of monuments that I may go to, like dolmens and court cairns and variations of style. And, I just find it surprising that I'm finding answers out there. I'm finding stuff that people haven't discovered yet because they haven't bothered to do the research. And yes, it is time consuming, but it's passionate and it's what I like to do. So if you can get the new publication of the book, I will say in mid to late November. So hopefully all being well, the new book will be out there. And that's the Megalith Acoustic Mystery. And you'll get that on jamesswagger.com.
We'll definitely have you back there. And we'll also link up the video so people can look at it. Awesome. Thank you so much, James. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you for your time today, Henrik. And bye to all the Red Ice listeners.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, there you go. Thank you for listening today. We also want to say happy Halloween. You might view it differently now when you know some more about the long traditional ancient European background to these celebrations and what the reasons for them might have been. We have lined up on the program Tracy Twyman, Brett Vinott, Brian Hooker, Arthur Topham, and Jason Erb, to name a few. Thank you so much for being a member, and we hope you have a great rest of your day. And by the way, if you are one of those that gorge on candy, or if you give it to the kids, find some of the better ones, organic or better ingredient ones. There actually are some options out there. We want you to stay healthy, with a sharp mind, and on top of things, so keep that in mind. All right, well, we'll be back in just a few days. Until then, take care. We'll speak to you soon.